Hello, Kumi-san, at the back. Okay. Welcome to this evening panel. My name is Kanno Navaratnam. I'm a psychoanalyst. I'm just going to introduce you the three presenters, and then we're going to watch the film. Petra Kovac is a PhD candidate at the University of Pech. She is doing her research in theoretical psychoanalysis. And her topics include trauma, memory, identity, literature, and film art. And Kathy Leonard is a senior assistant in the same faculty. She teaches on the MA and PhD program. She's also a member of the editorial panel of the Imago and Thalassa Journal. And the interest includes early relational development, attachment, and trauma. Now, M. Cooper is a director and animator. She's got a long-standing interest in psychoanalysis, as you will see. Her films are very unusual and unique. She combines live animation, or rather live action, with oil-painted animation, as you will see. The work is extremely painstaking. She paints each frame by hand, and you'll see the end product in a minute, and they are fantastic. Her films have been shown at the Edinburgh Film Festival, Sundance International Film Festival, and so on. The first film, Confusion of Tongues, was nominated for a British Animation Award in 2010. It's only 6 minutes, but it's all the more powerful for that. Nest, which is the second film, was premiered at the Vancouver Film Festival in 2011. I don't want to say any more, but just to say that M has a very gifted and intuitive understanding of psychoanalysis, and particularly on trauma and memory, I think. And she and I have the privilege of working together at the Tavistock Clinic and other places where we've done seminars on trauma together. Okay.
I would like just say a few sentences before we start to screen the movies. Thank you for the introduction and thank you for the invitation. It's a pleasure to be in here and present the movies with M and Kata together. And how we met with the movies, I don't know what is the sound. Last year we had the Hungarian Psychoanalytic Film Festival. And for Judith's suggestions, we wanted to invite M to present these movies, but unfortunately she couldn't come. So she sent the copies for me, and then we started to work with the movies with Kata together. And we just presented it on conferences, and also we were discussing it with the psychology students. And we were collecting the ideas, associations, feelings, and we tried to make an interpretation of it. And one more interesting thing is that we didn't know anything about M's motivation, interpretation. We just met in person right now, so I'm very curious and excited, and we will see the final result and the final interpretation. And Kata, you will.
Thank you. I would like to add what Petra said, that we showed this the both of the movies we are going to see now last week in a psychoanalytic conference in Hungary, and students as well. And now we would like later on to try to show those kind of people who are not psychotic, who are not psychologists and not psychoanalysts, and who has no any pre-knowledge about the trauma, and just show them and ask them for writing a narrative about it. Because as you can see, one of the, for us and from psychological point of view, one of the main the main feature for understanding this, the two movie is the intermediality between the animated part and between the living action. And how is the border between the two? Whether is it merging into one another? Whether is it very strict? Whether is it blurring into another? It's very interesting for us. And we call it visual montage. I don't know whether you can accept this. That's how we call it, visual montage. And because it was this chicken and egg question, what was before the confusion of tongues as an essay or the movie? Obviously, the essay was earlier because I'm here and Ferenc is here only in our mind. So it was interesting how her interpretation in the movie and in a visual language help us to understand the essay. And although Ferenc's writing is very, how to say, emotional, but it's still in language, and with the visual language, it helps to, I wouldn't say understand, and I wouldn't say interpret, but it helps to feel in our body, in bodily language, what we cannot describe, what we cannot interpret, and you will see that the different visual language has an effect on our primary instincting level to our body, and helps to trigger out the bodily memory. That's what we wanted to talk before that, and.
Okay, so we're very pressed for time, so we're going to watch the films back-to-back, and that'll be about 6 minutes and 11 minutes, so 17 minutes, and Petra, and then you'll have 15 minutes each, and hopefully we'll have about 15, 20 minutes to discuss. Okay.
I don't know, how do you feel after watching these movies? When I watched them first time, I felt very paralyzed, and they still can't touch me every time. So first I would like to offer you an interpretation for Confusion of the Tongues, so for the first movie. And I will use also Ferenc's papers, and I will try to find Ferenc's sentences in the movie, and I will try to find M's images and sounds in Ferenc's essay. So a young woman is haunted by a recurring childhood memory. The images of the nightmare show themselves as flashbacks first. Inner and outer reality are combined, as well as live action and all painted animation are combined in the movie. The open window is what starts the whole story, because it let the frightening contents to get into the conscious. The perspective is subjective, because as the girl is lying in her bed, we only can see her arms and legs, and we can feel as we were lying in the bed too. This point of view reminds us of the characteristics of the early perception, when the infant experiences himself in fragments. According to Lacan's theory, which is a very difficult theory, so this is just my Lacanian association, that first time when we perceive ourselves as a whole integrated one, happens in the mirror or happens through the other's eyes. this early perception can be discovered also in the surrealistic art, like Dali's art, because on these paintings, usually the parts of the body are connected to each other randomly, and the limbs are exaggerated usually. So this subjective perspective makes the space small, close, and sweltering, whereas the human body seems to be enormous, and this point of view mediates anxiety and fear. Later on, stories created from the small fragments and flashbacks. The story is told by using the technique of all-painted animation, and due to this tool, the image is fluent as it could slip out of our hands in any moment. It's runny, fluid, it's hard to touch and catch, hard to find a shape for it, hard to define. We find ourselves in a preverbal world. The non-narratibility of the trauma is transformed into an experience affecting our primary senses through images and sounds difficult to reflect and integrate. The perspective is still subjective because we are the one who is escaping. We can hear our own gasping, and the space is changing as we are running away. A little girl and her father are playing hide and seek, but this childlike game transforms into a dangerous and eroticized game. It is exactly how the language of tenderness and the language of sexuality misunderstands each other. Different languages and different dimensions lapse on each other, that results a real seduction. And I will quote Ferenczi. He says that they mistake the play of children for desires of a sexually mature person. When the father finds the girl hiding behind some boxes, an incorporation happens by which the aggressor and the victim became one. These children feel physically and morally helpless. Their personalities are not sufficiently consolidated in order to be able to protest, even if only in thought, for the overpowering force and authority of the adult makes them dumb and can rob them of their senses. The same anxiety, however, if it reaches a certain maximum, compels them to subordinate themselves to automata, to the will of the aggressor, to divine each one of his desires, and to gratify these. Completely oblivious of themselves, they identify themselves with the aggressor. Through the identification, or let us say introjection of the aggressor, he disappears as past of the external reality and becomes intra instead of extra-psychic, says Ferenczi. During the incorporation, the human hands transform into an animal paw, as we can see on the picture, which can symbolize the instinctive and aggressive side of human. After this identification, the perspective changes because we can see the girl from behind as she is escaping. So, whose perspective is this? We may can distinguish two subjective realities in the movie. First, the girl's reality, and second, the father's reality. The color red, we can see there, refers to the fact of seduction. As we know, a bull attacks when sees something red. So who is responsible for this trauma? Is the father who can see the dress to be red, or is it red, really? The Oedipal situation is a play, a fantasy, which shouldn't turn into real acts. But in the movie, a fantasy comes true. So whose responsibility is this? After the second incorporation, animal paws transformed into human hands again, and the aggressor represents himself as a bull-headed man, which can remind us of the mythology of the Minotaurus. And the same mythological reference will be found in the other movie. We will hear about that later. So this Minotaurus in the movie looks like he lost his frightening part, and he calls regret and pity from his victim and from us as well, because as we can recognize, the perspective changed again, and we are the victim again. Following Ferenczi's thoughts, we can interpret this episode as the victim introjected the guilt of the aggressor. The weight of the outrage presses the child. The girl tries to console the father, or saying it on the language of trauma, a role reversal happens. The child's desire for reparation results the traumatization. In the traumatic trance, the child succeeds in maintaining the previous situation of tenderness, writes Ferenczi in The Confusion of Tongues. And it is exactly the hardest point of attachment traumas when the aggressor and the caregiver person are the same. So the victim is not able to quit the situation because it is necessary for him or her to find a way to keep the relationship. It is important to make a difference between the two traumatic events because first time an innocent play turns into a sexual abuse and the second time the consolation results the re-traumatization. So after this, the monster vomits his victim who became a matured woman due to the trauma. It can be interpreted as a rebirth, but we have to consider that act of vomiting has negative connotations with disgust, for example. So the person after the rebirth can be the same that she was before the trauma. And I would like to use the metaphor of Agnes Heller, who is a Hungarian philosopher. And she says that trauma is like a gunshot. After that, the wound can be healed, but the scar remains forever. As we can see, after the rebirth, the woman is naked, as well as the bull-headed monster is naked. So he lost his animal and masculine look. And finally, the child became adult, and the adult became child. When subjected to a sexual attack, under the pressure of such traumatic urgency, the child can develop instantaneously all the emotions of mature adult and all the potential qualities dormant in him that normally belong to marriage, maternity, and fatherhood. The woman's gesture showed the act of forgiveness and acceptance. It's not possible to negate the fact of the trauma, but it can be a way of elaborating to try to understand the aggressor and fill the situation with feelings. In the final episode, we can see the girl sitting by her table and painting. The characters of the animated memory become lively on the papers. She becomes vomited by the monster, but the aggressor is brought up as well by making him an object on the paper. Through creation and art, inner contacts can transform into tangible, touchable, and material objects. As Ferenczi says that they experience the past no longer as a hallucinatory explanation, but as an objective memory. The last lights radiate calm. The window is still closed, but the room can admit the external world and let the light go through it. The movie Confusion of Tongues reminds me of the tale The Red Riding Hood, first of all because of the act of seduction and because of the act of incorporation, as the Little Riding Hood became eaten by the wolf, and finally she has a rebirth again because she can rescue. And both stories, I mean the tale and the movie, also includes the childish theory on adult sexuality, which is an aggressive and intrusive act in the child's mind. But it includes also the childlike idea about how the embryo get into the maternal body, because children usually think that mother swallows the baby. And finally, I would like to show some symbols. They are mostly common in the two movies. First, the window, which give a frame for the movie, because the open left window starts the whole traumatic memory coming back into the conscious, and the movie ends up with hit the window as well. And it's interesting that in Christianity, window is the symbol of Mary's virginity, because light can go through the glass without hurting it. And I think that glass is can be a connection between past and present, inner and outer reality, reality and fantasy, and so on. Yes, it's two pictures, one of the confusion of tongues, and the other one is from the nest. And the other main symbol are the hands, I think. They can represent stability in a world which is created by the ever-change of reality and fantasy. And they can be also evidences for the existence. We can see when the mother touches her wrist, and on our wrist we can feel our pulse, so we can feel that we are alive. And watching the hands can be also a kind of self-reassurance, and hands can connect and divine. They can hold and drop, they can defense, and they can create. And yes, and we are continuing with the interpretation of the nest.
Okay, then the next movie is The Nest. And before starting to talk about, especially about the movie, I would like to refer the multiplied symbol of the nest. The nest has a lot of meaning, so we can associate for hours to the nest as a holding environment, as a place to belong or a place to live, about family and so on and so on and so on. And what we find that there is a special drawing test, and I will just talk a very short about it, the bird's nest drawing test. It's a projective method using in diagnosis with kids and using in the therapy with kids. And would you show them? So we used a few of them. One of our students made a experience with kids in orphan. And the instruction was just draw a nest, and you can see that is that one downstairs. No. That's why we didn't make it bigger, because one of the coding there is a multiply coding system, and one code is whether he uses the whole surface of the paper or not. That's why we did not make it bigger, just like that, and you can see that. That is down, you know, without any tree. There is no tree, there is no chicken, there is no mom. This is another nest. The next one. Yes, you can see there is alone the baby, chicken waiting. Probably for food, but there is no mother. Yeah, and it was the nicest one, because we have to code the environment as well, and there is color on this drawing. Okay, that's all. Okay. So this drawing test is about how can represent the early attachment relationship, and some codes, whether the mom is present or not, whether the mom is abusive or not, whether the mom is abandoning the the kid bird or not, whether the bird is starving or not. And yeah, so it's really good to use for understand representation coming from the early emotional experiences. And then back to the movie. For our point of view, without talking with you, we think that this is two similar stories. Probably one of the mom point of view, probably, and the other is the daughter's point of view, or from the both point of view, and so we cannot decide it now. And what we want to capture in this movie is the transgenerational link of trauma. And basically we think that the trauma is connected to the mom. And we could see the flashbacks, Petra shows some of them. And these flashbacks refer to the mom, the original trauma of the mom, that she was sexually abused. And these flashbacks coming back, and because of her unresolved, encapsulated, unforgettable, but implicitly, unconsciously living memories in the present, her projection and perception of her daughter and of the relationship between the daughter and the father. So how she understand and how she is able to mentalize this relationship is about her negative projection and full with pathological content. So basically, I think this is the movie about. Yeah. And one question which came to our mind, and what usually when we talk about therapy, we used to say the here and now and there and then. And watching this movie, we were just thinking about where we are in the here and now, or there and then, or in both simultaneously, or there is no time at all. This question, the timing is not a valid question, or we are switching between the two. And as Petra said, that the oil painted animation and the living life action, how we call it, demands a different kind of coding system from the viewer, different kind of strategy we have to use. By switching between two, and how the borders between the two, how fluid is it, or what kind of is it? It's make a special meaning, and we can make a distinguish between implicit and explicit, or verbally understandable, which can be interpreted, or is it in fantasy, is it in the body language, it could be understood, rather the vitality effect, I refer to Stern, vitality effect, the movements, the colors, and the very basic senses, so rather senses and not words. Do I have time? Yeah, no? What is the next one? Yeah, okay. The mirror has a very special meaning in this movie, and as we know that in psychoanalysis, the mirror is a totem. how to say that, coming from Roheim and Lacan and Winnicott and so on, the emotional mirroring and emotional attunement, and it's really important. And in this movie, it's really used in special. It's used in not only the mirror but different reflective surfaces, like there is a spoon, or and there is the window. There are glasses which maybe have the same meaning. Yes. And this is what I was talking about, that we could see first the happy picture of the father and the girl, and downstairs the changing to the mom's perception. Okay. Yes, and it's just an example about the transgenerational trauma. We know we call it attachment trauma or multiplied trauma. It means that the trauma can be captured, the transgenerational or the trauma can be captured in the very small everyday moment to moment interaction. And we choose this because we could see in the movie that in the living action that the daughter drinks a milk with a straw. Well, it has a sexual connotation, and then from the mother's point of view, it becomes magnified, very big, and erotized. As a mouse sucking the milk. That could be the first picture. Then suddenly it changed to animation, and we could see the father, as the father Stang licks the envelope. It has a sexual connotation as well. And it's very, very important that he's with his tongue, he closes the envelope. It means that the secret is inside. So we can do anything, but the secret is encapsulated all the time. This thing that you use a lot of mythological. Yeah, there was you could see a kite flying part. It was very happy and nice moment, and we think that I won't go from picture to picture, but we can see how it transformed the Icarus. That's how I pronounce it. Icarus fall into the nothing, or into the. We could see that into the ocean, but maybe it's the Thalassa itself. We don't know. And here we think in the Winnicottian framework, which is the annihilation anxiety or unbearable fear, that in the case there is no good enough environment or holding environment, and Icarus without the holding wings falling down.
Thank you. It's open to the floor. Say a few words.
Well, yeah, like, oh my God. I feel really, I actually feel really quite emotional. Like, I kind of feel, it's just incredible. Yeah, it, it kind of blows my mind, like, how much you guys have understood from movies, because it's just amazing. We've never met before. And, you know, I feel like you really, really understood everything that I was trying to put in there. And it's just amazing when you've gone through it so sort of, you know, painstakingly and like taken out these images and talked about the different meanings. And, you know, I suppose it's like every filmmaker's dream. I just thought, you know, like I put all those things in thinking that I would hope that people might get them. And then, you know, they have. So and some interpretations were things sort of beyond, you know, what I think I probably intended, but, yeah, it just is really amazing for me. And just, yeah, incredible to hear all of these interpretations. So thank you very much.
You haven't mentioned the sound in the film. Could you say something about how the sound contributes to the total picture and the total story?
Do you have any thoughts on the sound before I jump in? I guess, you know, obviously sound is really, really important, especially in animation. And, I suppose what I wanted to create was very much atmosphere, or the feeling of, especially in Confusion of Tongues, the feeling of being inside, the feeling of point of view. So, the sense of being the protagonist, rather than seeing them and only seeing her at the very end when we come into objective camera work after the dream. So the sound is just really important of kind of creating that atmosphere of, like, especially the breathing and all that kind of feeling of being. And then, with the Nest, I was very, very lucky to work with a really talented composer, Sally Greenaway, who composed the music for the film. And yeah, again, sound was just so important, trying to create the atmosphere and create the feeling of memory, or the feeling of things returning, or the kind of, you know, moments of anxiety, that kind of thing.
Do you have any thoughts yourself?
Only that I was struck by how different the films would have been if they were silent.
If they say, you know, I believe that, especially animation is 80% sound, and films generally. I think, you know, you can't underestimate the importance of sound in a film.
I'm glad someone mentioned the music, because what the sort of impression that I got, the effect that the film had on me was actually quite visceral. And the way that you have sort of taken interpretation sort of makes it quite rational, almost, that you're sort of picking things and actually applying psychoanalytic theory to it. And I love the way that the music almost breaks through that. And there's almost something, the way that the music connects to some quite indistinct figures as well, that makes it, so instead of just a rational experience of sort of watching a film, I felt it, you know, something far more emotive and far more visceral and sort of watching it. So I like the fact that someone mentioned perhaps a tension between the music and certain things that you can't sort of rationalise, and sort of your rational interpretations as well.
What could you say about the special sound, which is the breath,
la respiration,
the breath, breathing. Thank you.
You mean in the first film, in Confusion of Tongues? Yeah. Well, I guess for me, I don't know, maybe it sounds too obvious, but really, for me, it's very important to have the sound of breathing because I am not showing the faces of the people. So, for me, and actually quite a lot of my work, I'm quite committed to this point of view experience. The nest, obviously we see the characters from the outside. I did originally plan the nest to be all shot from each of their points of view. So you wouldn't see the daughter when you were the daughter. But there was a number of reasons why that didn't work. But with Confusion of Tongues, we are the protagonist and that's a kind of feature of my work. And so, using the sound of breathing, it's another reason, in fact, why I've used animation, because in a way I've come to animation. I now almost predominantly animate, but I've come to it for a reason, which is I really want to try to portray the subjective experience, the feeling of being a character rather than seeing them from the outside. So, and what's it like to be inside somebody's head? What's it like to be in their position, in the world, and that's why I've made all the decisions that I've made. That's the root of it. That's the root of why I've become an animator, because I want to, and why I use oil paint in mixture with live action to try to, because live action to me doesn't represent what I see when I look out of my eyes. I see memories and thoughts as well as the world going on and everything in between as well, all at once. And for me, it's about trying to represent that in a crude way on film. But certainly using breath is a way of representing perhaps what's going on inside somebody's mind. Like if it's hard breathing, then you know it's sort of anxiety or something like that. It's an indicator to the audience of what the emotional content's going on.
Hey, thank you.
Excuse me, I just go over what he said. I think, moreover, you have that sound and the rhythm of the image, cut, and the rhythm of the drawings. And so sound, image, makes the whole person more present, not present as an image, present inside me, who looks much more than if there were portraits or anything like this.
Could you tell us something about the starting points of this film, Em? What made you make these films?
With Confusion of Tongues, I made them while I was at the Royal College of Art, and I had the idea for. I was explaining to these guys before, I wanted to make a film about that relationship between sort of the feeling of what is it like if you, this situation of abuse and what is it like if, in fact, you love somebody who's abusing you and that terrible dilemma and the identification with the aggressor. That's kind of what I was wanting to make a film about. And I kind of had some ideas, and to be honest, it wasn't coming to me in words, it was coming in images, and I just had this vision of this, the sort of, it was inspired by a Picasso painting of the Minotaur sort of rapist who also looks terribly, terribly sad, and the feeling of, just this kind of beast who can't help himself, and he knows he's about to do something awful, and he knows it, and you know it, and we all know it. And he can't stop himself. And that, to me, was I kind of had this idea. And then somebody suggested, I was talking about this idea, and somebody told me about the Ferenczi's paper. And I'd had like a kind of root idea. And then I read the paper, and it just totally blew my mind. And I was like, oh, wow, this explains in words things that I didn't know could be put into words. And so I could only see them in images. And so I kind of then went about trying to sort of translate the ideas into a film. And then the nest, I had more to say. I wanted to talk about, the relationship between a mother and daughter. I wanted to talk about envy between a mother and daughter and, transgenerational trauma and, a kind of terribly precarious situation in a family that where there isn't really any way of resolving it. And so that was the root idea, I suppose, and then I developed it into a film.
Can you hear me? I think you partly answer my question because I wanted to ask, in the first film, it's much clearer, who is the offender and who is the victim. In the second film, it seems like everyone are victims in a sense. But in your last reply, you said that actually you think that also in the first film, everyone are victims in a sense. So would you like to comment on that?
Yeah, I think that's the thing really is that one thing that I've understood from psychoanalysis, a very, very basic thing, it would be that sometimes abused people turn into abusers. And I think I felt that a lot of movies about kind of with clear victims and clear, you know, persecutors and things. And I kind of felt, well, what would happen if we actually felt for the abuser, and what would have, you know, and but at the same time felt for the victim, and perhaps those two are the same. Maybe the whole cycle will repeat itself. And I guess I just wanted to have empathy for everybody in that very difficult situation, including the perpetrator of the horrific, the violence. Yeah.
In the first film, The Confusion of Tongues, since we're kind of deconstructing the film with the paper, the piece that Ferenczi raises, which is almost the most fascinating aspect, that, and I don't know that that it's in the paper or in the film, which is when the abused child goes to the other parent, in this case it would be the mother, and is not believed, and is in fact doubly hurt by that. And in fact, Ferenczi, I think, in my reading, in that paper and afterwards, sees that as the larger trauma, if there could be a distinction between this trauma and that. But that piece is huge, and it resonates for me more and more as we look at child abuse and the whole phenomenon which is looked at. And I just wondered, did you kind of see, I didn't see it in the film per se, and I wondered the subtlety of that, I think, is often lost in the portrayal of sexual abuse. We've got abusers and abused, and there's this other piece that makes it a very, I would say, even more complex. And I'm just kind of raising that as something that I wanted to bring up.
No, I think absolutely yes. And I mean, there must be millions of things as well, you know, that weren't in the film that are in the paper. There's not, you know, and, you know, absolutely. But I completely agree with you. And I think that, you know, the film is just a kind of very small little kind of scenario, I suppose, that wasn't able to kind of have everything included. But I think that it's very, very important. And yeah, I would agree.
Last question.
What kind of situations do you show this film, and what is the reaction of, how do you use these films? I mean,
they've been shown at film festivals, and many, psychoanalytic conferences. Kanan and I also, have used them in a series of seminars in a teaching situation at Tavistock and other psychoanalytic seminar groups. So, it is very interesting to show them in a context of, psychoanalytic understanding and discuss them in that way. Sometimes I do show them in at other types of events, and they get a completely different reaction.
What?
Well, you know, the thing is, it's quite difficult for me because I'm caught between two stools using live action and animation. And sometimes they get shown in animation, situations. So let's say like a series of short animated films in a film festival. And sometimes that works out really weirdly because a lot of animation is either aimed at children or has a kind of like a lot of comedy, funny, quite, sort of light-hearted little films, and then there's that one. And there's and also the audiences who come quite often, you know, might be teenagers or young people or kind of, you know, people who might be interested in animation. So there has been some slightly weird reactions and some quite long silences.
Sorry, we have run out of time. It's a great finale to the day, so would you please join me in thanking Petra, and of course, Anne Tucker.